Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. George Mariner Maul has been the artistic director of the Discovery Orchestra since 1987. Personally, I've been very excited about the chance to interview George, as I first met him in 1985 when I was in eighth grade and had the opportunity to join the New Jersey Youth Symphony Cello Section, where he was the music director. I grew up in Plainfield, New Jersey, which happened to have a community orchestra that I played in, where George was also, you guessed it, music director of the Plainfield Symphony. So there are not many people that I have known as long as him, and he was obviously very influential in my career path and a longtime family friend. So this interview is extra special for me. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thank you, Joel, so much for asking me to join you.
So full disclosure, the Discovery Orchestra was founded by you and my father, Brian Dallow, in 1987, and it was founded in the traditional orchestra model and named the Philharmonic Orchestra of New Jersey. Over the years, your mission has changed, eventually leading to the current name change to the Discovery Orchestra in 2006. Talk us through this process of transition and tell our audience what your current mission and concert schedule looks like now.
Let me start by saying that I owe an enormous debt of gratitude, especially to your father, Brian, but also to your mother, Rena, as well as to my wife, Marcia. The four of us expended untold amounts of energy, time, and thought in getting the Philharmonic Orchestra of New Jersey up and running. Having gotten the orchestra into a functioning state, the next task was how to maintain it. I think one of the daunting realities facing anyone in the artistic world is the challenge of continuous fundraising.
Yeah, for sure.
A fact that specifically the professional classic music world in the United States, you have to come to terms with this. And after the Philharmonic Orchestra of New Jersey was functioning, in the beginning of our second year, which was the 1988-89 season, we began to receive our first requests from individuals that went something like this. Where could I get some instruction in classical music? I'd like to know more about it. Or maybe somebody would call and say, I took a classical music survey course when I was in college, but I feel like I really still don't understand it at all. Is there some course I could take? This prompted us to offer our first perceptive music listening course. It was a 90-minute session that I presented on the same night each week for 5 weeks. And as I recall, 12 people exactly signed up for the first course, which we gave in the choir room of a local church, obviously not on the night of choir rehearsal. And the participants seemed to enjoy it very much and talked it up with their friends, so that by the next time it was offered in the spring of that same season, just by word of mouth, we had 30 people sign up and had to find a larger space to put it in. The popularity of this course mushroomed. During the decade beginning in 1990, we began offering it several times in the fall and several times in the spring. And we began to move beyond the basic listening course, and we started offering specific courses on how to listen to the repertoire the Philharmonic Orchestra of New Jersey was going to play on its next concert. And those too became very popular. Pretty soon, adult schools and consortiums began to ask me to give these courses for their members in places like Maplewood and Montclair, New Jersey, Summit, places like that. And I began seeing about 1,000 adult students a season.
Wow.
In groups as small as 15 and much larger than that at a time. In the spring of 1996, the board of the orchestra, asked me if I could do in a concert with the orchestra what I do in my course mm-hmm. on stage. And I said, well, sure. And so in 1996, the 1996-97 season, the Philharmonic Orchestra of New Jersey presented our first Discovery concert in Richardson Auditorium at Princeton University. And it was very well received, except by one gentleman who thought he was coming to a regular concert and left in a huff. But him aside.
Well, you can't please everybody.
You can't. So early in the 1990s, we began being awarded annual grants from the New Jersey State Arts Council. Uh-huh. And the council required all of its grantees to develop strategic plans. So in the spring of that 1996-97 season, our board hired a consultant, of course, as they do, to help us create our first strategic plan. And Paula, who was our consultant, I can't remember her last name right now, but she put us through our paces, including doing a visioning session in which everyone in the room had to write down the top five things we would like to see in the orchestra's future. And we were encouraged to shoot for the moon and let our imaginations run wild. Well, when we were asked to read our lists, finally, one of the trustees started reading his list and he said, make a public television show out of a Discovery concert like the one we gave in the fall. Well, there were audible gasps in the room.
Really?
Yes. It seemed so preposterous. But when it came time for everybody in the room to rank all the ideas that had been put forth, the TV show got the most number one votes as a priority for the future. And the second highest was that we should do at least one Discovery concert each season going forward.
Huh. So a common theme there for sure.
Mm-hmm. In addition to any regular concerts we might give, I think you can see where this is going.
Yeah.
And it gives strength, I think, to the old saw, be careful about what you wish for.
Yeah.
The TV show wound up as an action item in the fifth year of that five-year strategic plan that commenced in July of 1997. So in July of 2000, we began the silent phase of fundraising to come up with a significant portion of the television show budget, and we were able to get four $25,000 pledges very quickly.
Wow.
Which amazed me. It seemed like an idea whose time had actually come, perhaps. Then, on September 11th, as we know, the world turned upside down at the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. The stock market quickly plunged south, and a lot of us thought, oh dear, this project is doomed. But by some miracle, in the midst of all this gloomy time, we successfully raised the entire budget by December.
Wow.
That was the board's cutoff date for a go or no-go decision.
Yeah. Can I ask you what that budget was?
I think $225,000.
Okay.
So the recording of Box of the Future was then scheduled for February of 2002, right before I was scheduled already to fly to Poland to make my first recording conducting the Polish National Radio Symphony Orchestra in March.
Oh, wow.
So it was an intense 2 months for me. I really felt under enormous pressure. But the TV show and the recording in Poland went off without a hitch. And the TV show was well received, seen by, according to the Nielsen people, by about a million viewers over its three-year distribution by American Public Television. And it was nominated for a 2013 Emmy.
Yeah, that's great.
I guess you could say that by then we were off to the races.
Yes.
In our move headlong into our current life. Now, during this time, discussions at board meetings began to take an interesting turn. And the long and short of it was this. There are lots of professional orchestras one can listen to live in concert in the New Jersey, New York metro area. You can go to Lincoln Center, listen to the New York Philharmonic. You could go to Carnegie Hall and attend concerts by the best orchestras in the world. You could go to the New Jersey Performing Arts Center and listen to the New Jersey Symphony, as well as other orchestras from around the planet. But the board members started saying, we've begun offering the public something they can't get at those concerts.
Yeah, for sure.
We were receiving unbelievable emails from TV viewers saying how Bach to the Future had changed their lives. So people began saying, maybe we should begin to focus only on presenting our educational concerts. Don't get me wrong, the board, our players and I really enjoyed giving regular symphonic concerts, and our audiences seemed to really enjoy listening to them. We were performing in the state's largest and most prestigious concert hall by then at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in that space called Prudential Hall. We were doing complete performances of Messiah during the holidays. And I remember one wonderful concert we gave in the 1999-2000 season, which we started with Copland's Dances from Rodeo, continued with Nadja Solano-Sonnenberg performing the Saint-Saëns Havanaise and the Ravel Zigane. And after intermission, we played Respighi's Fountains and Pines of Rome without a pause as one continuous composition with 110 players, including the brass players in the balconies. The audience, as happens always after the Pines of Rome, went nuts, of course, and we got several glowing reviews in the newspapers from that concert. But looking at the math, that concert cost us over $100,000 to produce between the hall rental, Nadja's fee, and the players' New York local 802 scale wages. Mm-hmm. If you divide that by an audience of the 1,500 people who came that night, that's about $66 per audience member. But since the highest ticket price was $35, that left another $50,000 to be filled in by our donors.
I see the problem there.
But Bach to the Future, with its $225,000 budget, divided by 1 million viewers over 3 years, meant it cost the Philharmonic Orchestra of New Jersey 25 cents to educate each TV viewer.
That's a huge difference. 25 cents or $66.
Yes.
Wow.
Okay. Our big contributors could easily see they were getting a much bigger bang for their contributed buck when we did a TV show.
Yeah.
It wasn't before long the board decided we should only present Discovery concerts. And in 2006, in yet another one of these strategic planning sessions, the board voted, and not before, a fair amount of contentious discussion, I might add.
Yeah, I believe it.
To change our name to the Discovery Orchestra and our mission to this. The Discovery Orchestra teaches the listening skills that help people really connect with classical music. And so, here we find ourselves.
Did you find that you were completely open to this change, or did it take some pulling you along for that adjustment also?
Not at all in my case. But there were other trustees who were coming kicking and screaming. I mean, they didn't want to be called the Discovery Orchestra. You can imagine, some of them had an emotional investment in being on the board of the Philharmonic Orchestra of New Jersey when they told their friends this at cocktail parties, right? Somehow Discovery Orchestra didn't have quite the ring, but yeah,
that is true. I could see that. And this really serves your passion.
Yes.
So I guess it goes along with your life mission to begin with, right?
It does. And when we had our last strategic three-year plan, which concluded this past June 30th, and by the way, we realized the world was changing too quickly to continue making five-year strategic plans.
Yeah.
It didn't make sense anymore. So the board voted in the last strategic plan, three-year plan, to gradually reduce the number of live concerts until we reached zero by this past June.
Wow. And your timing was kind of amazing.
What a coincidence. With the arrival of the COVID pandemic in 2020, we realized we'd actually made the right decision. So
yes, sort of fortuitously in front of everybody else.
we believe that we should focus only on creating educational content for the internet, radio, and television. Our mission has not changed for 15 years now. The Discovery Orchestra continues to teach the listening skills that help people really connect with classical music. We want people to have a visceral, emotional response to music that is possible only when we give our undivided attention to all of the elements of music as they unfold in real time. And we can't have this intensely satisfying experience if we're only hearing music while we read the program notes or scan the audience for attractive people that we could hook up with at intermission, or worst case, allow the omnipresent internal conversations that we have in our minds to drown out the music. If you have a conversation in your mind that's simple, like, I forgot to buy the green beans at the supermarket, that's not so serious. But if you're thinking, I'm going to have a confrontation with my boss, I don't know why he said that to me last Friday, but when I go in there on Monday, I'm going to give him a piece of my mind. And so you begin projecting what you think the boss will say and what you will say in response. If you take a conversation that's going on silently in your brain like that to a concert, you could miss the entire first movement of a Beethoven symphony, even though you were sitting in your seat.
Wow. So you're saying that if you're not pulling the listener in, then they're not going to pay attention at all.
Right. If they haven't learned to find really interesting things to notice in the music, let alone if they've not already made the decision, because they have to make a conscious decision to actually listen to the music and not just hear it as a background to other thoughts or activity, then they're going to be bored.
Yeah. It's interesting because I realize now that you say this, that I was running Riverside Chamber Players since 2003, and I founded it with the same mission in mind, which was to introduce music to people like they were in your living room. So I share your vision and mission for this. I guess the question that I have, and we do the same thing, by the way, we play pieces. We don't deconstruct them the way that you do, but yeah, we talk about them always ahead of time and bring new composers and really try and give the audience a chance to ask questions and interact during the concert. And then even afterwards, when they meet the musicians, to talk to everybody, which we always have a reception for that. I heard this a lot too. Well, I don't know anything about classical music, so I don't feel like I can come to your concert. And I would say, well, you don't need to know anything. Being in the room with live music and hearing a little bit about it and having that experience. We also, by the way, kept our concert short, 75 minutes, because that was another thing I felt, that if you make a concert too long, you may lose the listener that way. You want people to wish for more before they go home. You know, that they always wished you had played something more instead of, oh, thank God that's over. But why do you think that is then, that people feel like they have to know something about music before they come to a concert?
I think because they've had the experience of being bored, or they've been intimidated by what they think is some ethereal, highborn music that only the cognoscenti can really understand, not something I can understand. It's interesting. When I was a child, my mother was, like your mother, was a, and your father, very finely trained classical pianist. So there was music in our house all the time. And I just grew up loving classical music. But I also, being a child of the 1950s and 60s, loved the popular music that was out there. I mean, I discovered Elvis Presley, much to my mother's horror, when I brought home my first 45 RPM record of Elvis, or the Everly Brothers singing Problems, Problems, Problems All Day Long. I just loved this stuff. And I never felt like it was an either or situation. It was, there's this and there's this. And I enjoy them both very much. But that's partly because I had become a music listener as a little kid.
Yeah.
I had just developed the skill to be able to focus on the music and enjoy the crescendos and enjoy the chord changes and enjoy the dynamic changes. It's not like people have to know that Bach had a pet beagle or dachshund who licked his toes while he played the harpsichord. Let's leave that stuff for the music history professors.
Yeah.
But the vital things that they need to know are the emotional effect that one chord change can have when Brahms repeats the same melodic passage. One chord could devastate you, can make you start to cry because it's so powerful in its emotional content. But if you haven't thought about, first of all, giving your complete attention to the music, because after all, our society has trained us to ignore music. And I say that in all seriousness. It's what I call the Edison effect. The story goes that when John Philip Sousa was a young man, just actually when he had gotten the job as the conductor of the Marine Band, he had just been appointed to the conductorship of the United States Marine Band. And a friend of his traveled to see him in Washington and said, "John, you are not going to believe this. This guy in Jersey has invented this device that will record music and play it back." And the story goes, perhaps partly apocryphal, but not completely, that the color drained out of Sousa's face. And he said, "Oh dear, someday that will be the end of amateur music making." And although it took about 125 years for the prophecy to be fulfilled, it eventually was, because in our industrialized society, making music for most people is turning dials and pushing buttons. They never hold the violin. They never play the clarinet. They don't sit at the piano. They don't have an accordion or a banjo. Someone else makes the music. It's this whole separate class of people. And whereas up to the end of World War II, in every American household, regardless of social class or wealth class, people had instruments and made music at home. They sang at home. I can remember my grandparents, whom we lived with, sitting at the piano, my grandmother and my grandfather singing with each other at night, just for their own amusement.
Yeah.
This evaporated. Why? Because of the Edison effect. And once technology advanced to the point where those sounds could be electronically reproduced, we were lost. If you think about it, in the industrialized world, since World War II and beyond, you're almost never without electronically reproduced music in the background. If you go to the supermarket, if you go to the dentist office, if you're sitting on hold on the phone, it's there everywhere. And it has trained people to not listen to music, but just have it as sonic wallpaper. If you go into a restaurant, you can do an experiment with friends. After about 20 minutes, ask someone at the table if they liked the last tune that was on the sound system. And some people will say to you, "Was there music on?"
Yeah.
That's how bad it's gotten. So at the Discovery Orchestra, there are always two primary things that we try to do. One is to awaken people to the idea that, gee, I'm not really listening right now.
Yeah.
It's happened before in their lives. Who has not stood in front of their mother when they said to them, "Are you listening to me?" And that's because your mother knows that your mind is 10,000 miles away. And even though you're standing right in front of her, you're not listening to her. So we've all had that experience. But that combined with, are we really listening to music, is something many people have never really thought about. It's just there in the background. So you have to cause people to have an aha. At one of our concerts, at each concert, we make people have an aha about whether they're really listening or not. It's not nice. What we do is we play a trick on them. We say, "We want you all to raise your hands when the violins play in the next excerpt." And of course, we start playing and the violins never play. We play the wrong music on purpose.
Yeah.
And they're sitting there. And after a while, a few people are snickering and laughing. And so you say, "Is there something wrong?" And then, "Well, the violin didn't play." And I said, "Yes, we wanted to make sure that you were really listening."
Yeah.
And then we give them a tiny little spiel about the difference between hearing and listening. So once they've made a decision to listen, then the question is, what are you going to listen for?
Yeah.
And that is the elements of music and the aspects, various aspects of the elements of music, all of them, rhythm, melody, harmony, timbre, texture, form, dynamics, all of those elements of music come into play in the music that we love so much, especially in the music that we love so much, because it's wordless in most cases. Wordless abstract music. If you ask a kid who's like 14, "I'd like to play you a 5-minute piece now by this guy, this dude named Mozart. It's a wonderful piece of music. It's very exciting, but it has no words." They might say, "How could it possibly be any good if it has no words? Because for most of the human population, song is the only genre of music that exists.
Yeah, that's true. I guess it was making me think, too, that we're in such a time now where things come at us so quickly that we're not used to having to actually work to actively listen to something. Because this actually sounds like work now. Now you're saying I have to go to a concert and I have to actually listen also?
Yes, it is work, but it feels really good. What happens is that we teach people to notice things like stretto or sequence, ascending. We might ask them, count the number of steps in this sequence. Well, we don't teach them that so that they can sort of amaze their friends at parties by a piece of music Beyonce, and they're, oh, there's an ascending sequence just to show off. We're teaching them this so that they notice sequence when it's happening in a piece by Brahms, and they feel the effect of the tension building as Brahms is moving up step by step in this piece of music. That's what we want them to do while they're listening, to feel the emotional effect of a crescendo or a subito piano or whatever it is, or a chord change.
Yeah.
That's the important thing. It doesn't feel like work after a while because it feels so good.
You know, I was about to ask you what's the most exciting and rewarding part about your work, but I think I can already answer that based on how animated you get talking about getting the audience involved and getting people really listening. So clearly that is the most exciting and rewarding part for you. So, well, then let's back up for a second here. If you could go back and do it all over again, knowing where you are now and knowing the journey you've taken as a conductor and where it's led you to, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I would tell myself, everything is going to be all right. I have a tendency to go toward the darker, pessimistic view of things. And I've wasted a lot of my life fretting about things that never happened or regretting things that happened that I thought should not have happened.
Yeah, that's good advice. So your orchestra has been on the cutting edge of technology, even before the pandemic, as we talked about earlier. You've produced 5 television shows to date. You have a YouTube channel with over 180 short videos called Discovery Chats, and a monthly series where you're the host giving personal anecdotes about your life experience called Notes from Under the Piano, which I love. I think it's great. How do you see the profession changing further due to COVID? And considering how nimble your orchestra's already been, do you think you'll even need to adjust more than you already have? Or are you poised for success right now?
I think our attitude is that we want to keep our eyes open, especially toward technological changes. In the newest strategic plan that we just created, the next 3-year plan, which we just started in July, the whole emphasis is on spending our time and resources during this period on further promulgating what we've already created, combing information about platforms and other distribution channels so that we can get the maximum mileage out of all the content we've already created. We're already planning our next television show. 1 year from now, we're going to record for American Public Television a discovery concert on the finale of the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony. Mm. And we're really looking forward to that. And we'll be planning all year long to get there. But in this moment, especially COVID on the profession, as you know, it's economically decimated many musicians in the New York metro area, as well as adversely orchestras that they play in. And then there's the classical audience itself. It tends to be older, and I think the jury is out as to whether people over 50 are going to be willing to return to sitting 3 inches from each other in our venues. We'll find out. Hopefully, audience attendance will return to pre-COVID levels, but I guess depending on how the latest Delta variant surge is going in a given geographic area, it may take a while to return to what we think of as normal.
Yeah.
Actually, a much larger concern that I have around the entire professional classical music industry in the United, if you can call it an industry in the United States, it involves the economic model on which it has more or less functioned for over 100 years. Ticket prices, as we know, never cover the actual cost of a classical concert. It's not like a rock or popular music concert where tickets cover more than the cost of the concert. They actually make money for the promoters. As opposed to a professional classical music concert in which a donor class of individuals contribute the difference between ticket income and the actual cost of concert production. Here's what worries me. The classical music donor class is aging and dying across the world, but also in the United States. Mm-hmm. And here in the Northeast, our donor class is also retiring and moving to places like Sarasota, Florida.
Yeah.
The question is, who will replace them? Are there young millionaires and billionaires out there who want to make huge annual contributions to symphony orchestras to keep them afloat? I remember I had dinner with Peter Benalil, who was the former board president of the Philadelphia Orchestra. And this was in 2011 when the Philadelphia Orchestra filed for Chapter 11 protection. Mm-hmm. And he said to me at that dinner, "I don't know if in a few decades there will be enough wealthy people in the Philadelphia metro region who will care if there's a world-class orchestra here."
Yeah. Well, you know, it's not unlike a sports team in that way, that when you look at the salaries of the players, those aren't made up by seat ticket sales. You're only playing 8 home games a year. So it's different because we don't have the exposure. We don't have the television rights and the commercial rights that are what are paying the difference between the ticket price and what it costs to run an organization like that.
No, we have very kind people who, out of their generosity, are willing to give us major contributions, and a lot of individuals who give us smaller ones. But it's not like the advertising of a television show for the Super Bowl, which generates who knows how much money.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, and here you are making television programs.
But
so
but the economics of it are these. They're on public television, and public television functions like a symphony orchestra. Public television itself, the main office in Washington, D.C., as well as American Public Television, which is a distributor of shows in Boston, they are both nonprofit 501c3s, and each individual station is a nonprofit 501c3, all needing contributions to make them function. So the Discovery Orchestra makes its first public television show in 2002 and sends it to American Public Television, the distribution house in Boston, hoping that they would find it worthy of national distribution. We didn't know.
Uh-huh.
It's like on spec. We were hoping they would like it.
Yeah.
So they loved it, and they said, "All right, since we've deigned to accept your television show, for the privilege of our distributing it to various public television stations across the country, you will pay us X amount of money in addition to the cost of the television show that you've already created to distribute it." And that's the way it works. And each of those public television affiliates pays a fee annually to American Public Television for the right to draw these shows down from the satellite and broadcast them locally. So it's all a contributed income situation. So it's not quite like commercial TV or satellite TV, a million channels you can get that are paid television, where it's a wholly different for-profit industry.
Yeah.
That's where the sports fit into that model. Unfortunately, public television is in as difficult shape as symphony orchestras are. And they're trying to figure out how to survive. And as you know, if you watch public television, every few weeks, someone's pleading with you to send money to this local public television station.
Yeah, we're all in the same boat. We're all asking the same people for money.
The very same people.
Exactly.
Right. The people who help make our concert possible are also asked by their local station to give money to them. Here in New Jersey, when you think about the economics of classical music, you have the individual orchestras that exist in the state asking their donors to help make their concerts possible. Then they give those concerts at the Arts Center in Newark, which also asks the very same people, "Please give us money to keep this facility running." Even though those orchestras are paying rent to the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, the Arts Center still needs contributions as well to keep it running. So it's not the best economic model. That's why I'm so concerned about, you know, It's quite a thought.
I think people have been concerned about this for a long time. We've heard the phrase many times, the model is broken. So I mean, it's something
we're But I don't know if we've fixed it yet.
I don't think we have, but we're working on it. Well, in the interest of time, do you have any other advice that we haven't covered that you might like to offer to young musicians who might be listening to this podcast?
Absolutely. Take care of your physical and mental health. You can't give performances if you're severely disabled by illness or you're dead. I say this because for many years, I smoked cigarettes, consumed alcohol, and ate unhealthy foods to great excess. Uh-huh. And in 2005, I received a frightening, but lucky, timely warning when I had a heart attack.
Oh, wow.
And since then, I don't do any of those things anymore. I've taken off 50 pounds of weight. I walk regularly. I don't know how much tread life I have left on my tires, but at nearly 74, I hope I've given myself a few more years.
Well, good for you. We do talk about that a lot on this podcast, is how important it is to take care of yourself. Mental health is important, physical health, not to give up on everything else just for the practice room, because that won't give
you success. It's not going to cut it. Yes. Yeah.
Your body is a machine and you have to treat it that way. And if you don't treat it with respect and the way that it needs to be, it will not do what it needs to when you're under pressure, for sure.
Not really.
So let's talk about then where people can find all the materials on the Discovery Orchestra and where they can find you online to further see what you're up to.
The best place to find us is at our website, discoveryorchestra.org.
Okay.
O-R-G. And there you can find access to all of our stuff. And what is not there, it will tell you where to go. Mm-hmm. So primarily, I would say visit our website. However, if you choose, you can go to Amazon and find not only our TV shows, but also some of our YouTube Discovery chats are also featured there on Amazon.com. And I think, as I told you, we're going to spend these next 3 years trying to dig up any possible channel that we can to distribute our materials further, because right now we only have our website and Amazon. We do have an educational distributor in New York City. That's called the Films Media Group. Mm-hmm. They are like the country's largest repository of public television shows on every possible subject. Art history, Bill Moyers, political commentary shows, everything is up there. And they also have our television shows and a good number, probably 30 or 40 of our YouTube Discovery chats there. And what they do is they license universities, high schools, colleges. And if a university chooses to have a license with Films Media Group, they have access to their entire library on any subject. So our stuff is being streamed to classrooms across the country. We don't know, sadly, they will not tell us who buys our stuff. Oh. It's against their covenants with their clients. So, you know, all this time we know, please tell us which universities, which school districts, who's getting it. But they don't tell us, but we do receive, not huge, but nice residual checks from them.
Uh-huh. Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
It's been my pleasure. As you know, you're one of my favorite people in life and have been since I met you when you were in eighth grade, did you say?
Somewhere around there, somewhere seventh around. Or eighth grade,
yes,
yeah.
Right.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview Avi Friedlander, the director of the Barston Suzuki Center at the Music Institute of Chicago. We're here to serve you, so if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us, @thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was produced, edited, and recorded by me,